start in about 2-3 minutes. Once we get everybody in from outside, and I'm going to pass it over to Chez, who's got the wireless mic this time, so he's going to roam around. Are you going to be in the way?
No,
you're
on.
Okay. Apparently, I said I was going to get a questionnaire out. The questionnaire never got made because of other related problems with the hotel. You can guess what they were. So I'd really like to get your feedback, though. You can send me email. We already have a lot of ideas on what we're going to change, but it's always good to get feedback, good or bad. Otherwise, we don't know what to change and what to improve on. So feel free to drop me email, and we'd like to hear from you and input for what kind of tracks you'd like to hear. So with that said, we can close down those doors, and we can pass it on over to Chez, Bubble Master. Take it away. And thanks for putting up with everything, guys. You were great. After this is over, that's it. I'm not big on closers. You can tell me what you think about it later. And I hope to see a bunch of you at DEF CON. We're starting registration tomorrow around 10. So see you guys there if you're showing up.
Testing. She stood on another. It's not working. I turned it off.
There's another one there.
There we go. Testing.
Yeah, okay.
Got it. Great. By the way, this single item is the best conference giveaway I have ever seen.
Yes.
And I have been to dozens and dozens of conferences. Okay. Well, you know, what's this talk about? Well, I've been a science guy since fourth grade, and a very lucky one. I ended up at Bell Labs, which is filled with science guys and gals. In fact, I hang out with Bill Nye every once in a while. We're science guys. And so I like science. In fact, my degree is in fundamental science from Lehigh. We didn't have a computer science degree, so I made one up. I mean, they had this thing called fundamental science, which is a bunch of different science stuff, and then go off and do the math and information science and electrical engineering and sort of build a degree out of it. And the dean was cool with it, so that's fine with me. And I even learned how to spell fundamental before I actually graduated. So it was good. I was a terrible speller. So what happens is I've been invited all over the world to give talks, and it's been one of the side effects of writing the security book. And it's been really great. I mean, people, you know, they'll pay for me to go to Germany to give a talk. They'll pay for me to go to New Zealand to give a talk. I said, well, heck, we'll connect the dots and go around the world. I mean, it's been a wonderful life, and it's just great. And I thank a lot of you who have bought the book or been supportive. It's been great. But when a security guy goes around the world, and you are mostly security people of some sort or another, you start noticing things about security that you might not have noticed before. And so what this is sort of a travelogue in time and space, looking at security things I've seen. And if you get a little bored, if the picture's got a little monotonous, wait a few minutes. I'll be boring about something else in a couple minutes further on. I'm going to cover some science here. For those of you who slept through biology or went to the computer lab instead, you may get some that you hadn't gotten before. So this science is so new that a lot of people may not agree with it. I may not understand all of it. I'm a science guy. I'm not actually a PhD in molecular biology, for example. And we're going to do a little of that today. And so even experts disagree, and I may just get it wrong. And sometimes people come up after this talk and set me straight on it. And that's great. I'll change the slides for the next time I give the talk. Okay. I actually have a lot of slides here. We're going to go through quickly. Even though it's open-ended, I'm not sure how long you actually want to sit here and listen to this babbling. This talk was inspired by a trip to the Baltimore conference I took a couple years ago, when some ex-spook came up to me and said, you know, I've been in counter-espionage for 20 years, and now I'm retraining myself in computer security. And the thing he said is, it's all the same stuff. The same rules we had over in counter-espionage, we have in computer security. The details differ, but it's all the same stuff. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, is it's all the same stuff. Okay, so we're going to start with perimeter defenses, which includes the pretty good wall of China. Now, the pretty good, oh boy, We're going to be doing some swapping here today. The Chinese don't actually use this name for this wall. they think it's better than that, and it is an awesome thing to visit, I can tell you. But when I actually go and try to read about it in encyclopedias and books to find out, I'm the security guy, I'm coming in to do a cost-effective analysis, did this thing actually work? And I get mixed results out of it, but the answer seems to be, well, sometimes. In fact, it was originally built not to keep armies out, but to keep those Mongol traders from coming in and messing up the Chinese economy. And for doing that, it does a good job. I mean, you would not want to charge up this hill and attack this thing. On the other hand, many people have told me that this is just a delaying action, and the whole idea of the wall was to hold them off long enough so the signal fires could summon the armies of peasants to come and defend it. At any rate, Genghis Khan walked through the gate and basically walked into Beijing. So it failed in that point. And of course, it goes down to the ocean. It can't go any farther than that, so you can go around it. Does this sound familiar? You know, no matter how far out you build it, you get in a boat, you can sail around it. So there's that too. I said that already. Good. A wall is a single layer of defense, of course, and this was fairly reassuring. And they had cheap labor, so it was easy to do this. And so we have lots of pictures of the wall. People have driven Volkswagens down these things. And it's just amazing. It goes off into the distance. It goes over a number of time zones, and they added more to it. And all it took was peasant labor, which was very cheap. So that's one form of perimeter defense. And as you can see, we've gone through 12 of the 112 slides, and we're actually waiting for the disc. Here is actually a satellite photo where you have version 2 of the wall, and version 1 was this part that shows up mostly from satellite. It turns out the wall is not impressive for the whole length. It's like any other security, where they can see it on the mountaintops or in the popular valleys, it's a wall. In other places, I am told, it's just a pile of rocks. You know, well, nobody goes down there. It's okay. We, you know. Does this sound familiar? which reminds me of the crummy wall of Lucent. We have at least five firewalls and probably two or three times that many. I don't know if anyone knows how many we've got. I've done a scan with my network mapper and found 266,000 hosts. We've circled the wagons around Wyoming. 200 extra nets that we know of, and I think it needs balkanization. We need little walls. And I'm not just up here trying to sell firewalls. I don't think I can defend more than about 40 hosts. It just gets too big. Thermopylae, or for those who are self-educated, thermopile, is another similar wall situation where there was, I'm sorry, it's 600 Spartans, I believe, defended a narrow pass and basically kept the ravening Persian hordes at bay until farmers showed them a goat path to go around and come back and kill those brave Spartans. And it turns out that's happened three times in history where somebody has stopped a major army and then the army's figured out how to get around. So, I mean, you just study your military history and you can find out how, you don't go through security, you go around it. The Chinese palaces have many walls and doors. If you actually go visit one of their temples, you pay your Zenotex or Zorkmids or whatever, and you go in, and you go through about three layers, and you're getting closer to the middle, and you see lots of stuff, and there's another more walls and doors, and there's someone collecting more Zorkmids. And if you want to go inside, you have to, you know, give more of this paper money and go in further. And there are many opportunities for defense and for charging admission. They also have trip walls for spirits. Here's what the inside looks at one. I guess this is the Summer Palace. And you go in through these doors here. This is a firewall for stupid demons. Turns out demons don't have feet. They trip, so they can't get through them. So all the temples have these little firewalls on them, and you step over. And so you've always got to watch your feet. Someone said, no, that's not it. There's lots of dust in Beijing, and this keeps it from getting inside. And, well, you know, you can take that for what you want. Is there a comment here?
Looks like a packet filter.
Well, packet filters could be a lot better than that. I mean, they're hard to get right, but Okay, so here's another perimeter defense, the U.S. Capitol building. You can see the wall right there. I am, of course, referring to the flower pots. Yes, indeed. Let's have a close-up of these flower pots. Someone tell me what plant is growing in there?
Is it a real plant?
Impatience, right. And these things are all around. There are hundreds of them around the building. And this is a firewall. I mean, we won't go back. We'll just look. See, here's a place you could drive a truck bomb through, except there are three flower pots there. And I wonder how many tourists wheel their strollers around these things and not realize what their true function is. But if you actually look up, you can see they fade off into the distance. We've got them all the way around. And here's what part of the integral defense system. He says it takes most of a day for him to go around and water all of the flower pots. He happened to be there. He knew they were part of the defense system. Here they're actually linked together with a chain so that if you hit them hard, you can't blast a hole in them. They sort of stick together. Here is a firewall in this. I should tell you that even walking around with a digital camera, I'm a little uneasy photographing security arrangements at the Capitol. These are guards here. They've got a dog and so on. And we'll talk about what's back there in the corner over here. This stuff right here, I'd point at the screen, but it doesn't work. In a moment, I was a little uneasy about this. So, you know, of course, the digital camera you look down at, and they can't tell that you're taking a picture. There's no flash or anything. So maybe it looks like I'm at the Capitol building. I was actually photographing them. And we can talk about these things, which are a firewall for cars. And what they are, I know there are a number of spook-like people here who know what a delta barrier is. This little thing pops up out of the ground, and I can assure you, you can hit that really hard with a truck, and you won't get through. And they push a little button in the shack, and it goes down, and you can drive over it. Turns out they stay down for 30 seconds by default. I sat there admiring the Capitol building, seeing just how these things work. It turns out it stays down. Someone drives up, he hits a button, it stays down for 30 seconds and pops up. I am told they have a panic mode, where they say, oh shit, someone's coming, bam. And there is a story someone told me that at the State Department, a limousine had not quite made it through the Delta barrier when someone pressed that button, and a VIP got flipped over when the Delta barrier went wham. Anyway, that's sort of a cool little perimeter defense there. And of course, there are the flower pots there, so you can go down through them. And you can see, oh, there's the lane right there. Yes, that's good. Okay, so what else do we have? So when I was visiting London, of course, I had to visit Parliament. And here they have, this is the entrance to Parliament. There is a Delta barrier here. Here is a hole in their firewall. You can drive right around it. What's more, this is one of those stick-type defenses that you might have seen in the old Mission Impossible shows. You know, Mr. Phelps has just gotten the diamonds or got the confession or killed the person, and now they're leaving the East European People's Republic, and what do? There are two guards who say, gee, what's going on? And this car goes 60 miles an hour through this stick, boink, and they're off to freedom, gun bullets shining. Well, I mean, security isn't like that. What that stick really does, I mean, if you're really doing this, is you have the stick 5 miles inland from the border, 3 miles you have an army barracks. So there's enough time to say, someone broke my stick. Now, there really isn't that much time. I suppose if you broke the stick, they might be able to hit the button on the Delta barrier pretty quickly and pop that up and give you a good bump in the road. Of course, the purpose of the stick is not to stop a truck bomb. It's to show intent. You want the bad guys to reveal their cards. And in fact, showing intent is a layer in layered defenses. Make them show their cards. I haven't been to Quantico yet, but I understand that there's an arrangement like that, an outside gate and an inside gate some miles inside. And presumably, some nice little button that says our stick is broken. This is the entrance to Parliament. I also took the liberty of photographing the exit. Apparently, the bad guys are much too polite. It's just not done. We don't drive in the exit. There appears to be no defense here except for the Minister of Silly Walks. And since my hotel was right near the new Scotland Yard, I checked that out too. We do have a fairly substantial stick here, though you can still go through it. Of course, someone who comes from a country of nitrate and fuel oil bombs, seems to me you park it here, start the fuse, run like hell, and this building is mostly gone in about 2 minutes. But apparently that's not done either. And now, lest you think this is all about buildings and such, this is actually a stained sample of cells in my cheek. And Oh, you just scrape them and put them on a slide, stain them a little bit. I think we use food coloring for this. Looks much better here than up there. I guess I need more contrast. At any rate, these cells, of course, are surrounded by a cell membrane, which is very much a perimeter defense. I mean, you've got chemistry and stuff going on inside and stuff going on outside. And one of the biggest things that bacteria and viruses need to do is figure out how to get in and get into the machinery and muck up the works. And then there's this whole defense system of the body trying to decide if there's somebody bad inside that cell. Because if they are, they just kill the whole cell. And then there are virus counterattacks that say, well, we'll mess up that system so they won't know we're hiding inside the cell. It gets wonderful. It's just great. The plasma membrane works as a wall. Okay, it has many it actually has many, many firewalls. We're discovering them almost daily. These are little protein holes that will open up for calcium ions or for a hormone or something like that. And they're just all over there. It's interesting research there. There are pumps to pump in water, pump out arsenic, to get iron, molybdenum, selenium, and so on. And in fact, we'll talk about it briefly. You can actually look at the source code for this now. It's pretty cool. There is recent evidence that cells actually may open connections between them. These are extranet connections. And yes, the obvious security problem appears to occur. There are some types of brain diseases that may spread through these little holes. So you want your defenses to be layered. You want defense in depth. Belt and suspenders, safer. Well, you all know this sort of stuff. So we'll move on and see some as soon as this disk is ready. It is loading its next stuff as fast as it can. There we go. There's Lorton Prison. Turns out if you look from the air, you can really tell high security defense areas because they have two layers and lots of grass. I mean, if you're interpreting photos of the Soviet Union, they do this all the time. And you say, ah, that's a secret place. And you can actually tell there are two layers, two different kinds of security here, and no connections between them as well. Heidelberg Castle, which was started in the 1300s. These castles tend to take centuries to build because, you know, there's lots of overhead. You've got to pay the mortgage and so on. Here's some sample of layering. You come up this hill, and it's in Heidelberg. It's a beautiful city. I recommend you visit it. And if you're attacking this castle, you've got arrow slits over there, and there are people shooting at you while you run along this narrow little area and come up to a door. Now, you must remember that the idea in war is not to die for your country, but to make the other fellow die for his country. So you've got to get through this door while people are shooting at you. And eventually you do, and you burst triumphantly into this little area here, which has more doors and more arrow slits. You see where I'm going with this? This carries on. More arrows, places to shoot down at you, pour boiling oil, any, you know, whatever defensive measures you want. Narrow little areas. This sort of enclosed area, so you can fight in the rain, I guess. They're still shooting at you. And down at the end, more arrows, more opportunities to die for your country, and then you round the corner and they collect your tickets. And once you get inside, of course, there's a cement mixer because they're doing construction in there. Failure modes. How do these castles break? I've been trying to find this information out for various castles. In 1622, Tilly captured the castle after a two-month siege. Siege is interesting attack. Denial of service attack, right? though it's a little different. You don't give them too many packets. You make sure they don't get any packets. And of course, a few years later, 30,000 Frenchmen took it over in about 3 hours of fighting. Turns out there were only about 300 defenders. They weren't buying enough system administrators to keep the thing secure. This is a management lesson. It's always hard to decide how many of these people you want to have around when you really need them. And it turns out, in fact, the moat is even drainable. It makes a lovely garden, and then you can divert. I don't actually know where they get the water to divert it, to fill it up, to make it a moat. So it's in good times. Here's the actual bad thing that happens. The French come in, and they set off, they blow up the tower that's got all the ammo in it. And you can see there are thick walls and so on. Also, this part up in the front is called the clock tower, and apparently it pissed the French off muchly because they blew it away, and it hasn't been fixed since. Intimidation is a layer, though. Going up a hill with lots of people shooting at you, maybe I'll go attack something else. Maybe that security system looks too good. Maybe I might get caught. Fort Knox is sort of like that. I mean, they've got regiments around it and so on. Do you really want to try to drive in and haul away the gold? You know, there are better ways of doing it. Besides, gold is getting cheap these days. Clark.research.att.com was an old scratch machine we had on our external net. It was used by students for a few years and then sort of ignored. And you know what happened. It was running old tricks. We tried to secure it, but we didn't try very hard, and we forgot about it. And the Internet Liberation Front got in. I don't even know how they got in. Could have been PortMapper. Why was that running? I don't know. Could have been SendMail. Why the hell was that running? Don't know. Anyway, they got in, and they tried to run this loop. Actually, they ran it quite successfully. They had this long screed about how they own the world and look at all these people they've got. And they tried to have us mail it from the prestigious ATT address to CERT and Wired and Newsday and Dateline at News, you know, some of these, and AP News and so on. And when we finally discovered this a few days later, I found that one of the things I had done was turn off execute permission on user live send mail. So we had 800,000 error messages trying to send this message out. Now, they could have fixed this, but the layer, the last stupid layer of turning off execute on SendMail actually kept AT&T from some embarrassment. You know, these layers help. Even though they never thought of it, they could easily have gone in, turned it on, and done it. So also in your dignity and your good name are your most valuable assets. And in fact, there are people at Lucent who think our logo is our most valuable asset. I leave that to you to decide. But the good name, you know, clearly is very important. And often, it's much worse to appear on the front page of the New York Times than it is to actually be hacked and have secrets stolen. At least overtly, obviously, managemently, like that. Other sorts of defenses, we turn to plants. Now, a plant can't run away from a bug. I mean, it's kind of stuck there. So what does it do? Plants turn out to be spectacularly defensive. They have hundreds of poisonous chemicals in them, and yes, that includes the fruits and vegetables that you love to eat. They are full of carcinogens, potent cancer agents of any sort, poisons, cyanide, and so on. Now, it turns out that the human body appears to be pretty well equipped to handle this barrage. But the whole point of the plant was, I'll make lots of different defenses. So if a bug eats me and it's resistant to this other stuff will still get it. I mean, peppermint is my favorite insecticide. So if you're a plant that has only one predominant chemical, such as eucalyptus plants, all they need to do, the attackers need to do, is really deal with the eucalyptus oil and they can get in. This happens. Here is just some of the evil-sounding chemicals, the natural chemicals that appear in cabbage, which may or may not be your idea of good food. I think cabbage is what food eats. It turns out for you organic folks and everyone else that if you eat your fruits and vegetables, you're probably eating about 1.5 grams of pesticides a day. They're all natural, and it's probably okay. You can go look at the work of Bruce Ames from Berkeley if you want to hear more about this. It's very interesting. And of course, organic farmers pick plants that don't need to have pesticides put on them. This seems to do well without it. What's happening? The plant has been cultivated to increase its natural pesticides. So it's doing it for you. And preservatives, don't get me started, they are wonderful. The stuff they put in cereal boxes, BHA, actually protects mice from liver cancer. Young oak leaves come out. The young oak leaf is version one. You know, we got to get out there and start sucking in the photons. And they're actually fairly easy to eat. But after the tree gets going, version two, which they do get around to, unlike humans, actually is a wonderful mix of chemicals. And it's why many people are allergic to oak, is that they have lots of poisons in them to try to keep the bugs away. Said that, all right, good. The mammalian immune system has many layers as well, physical barriers like skin and mucus and cilia and so on. And there's also this innate system. There are some things that the body just knows from experience, historically, this is bad. If you ever taste this chemical, it's bad. It doesn't have to learn it. It doesn't have to be attacked. We don't know that much about the innate immune system. The acquired immune system is the one we all know about with vaccines and stuff. You get a cold, you get some disease once, and the system says, oh, this is bad. Won't let it happen again, boss. And so it's sort of like logging it. and you have these little logs floating around. They always remember that. But yes, I really hate the chicken pox you had when you were five. And if it ever shows up again, we're pretty ready. Obscurity is another layer of defense. Now, many people will tell you don't depend on security by obscurity, and they're right, because that's the only if that's the only layer, you don't have enough layers. But there is a reason why the Department of Energy doesn't explain exactly how they protect all their plutonium. They want that extra layer for you who want to go fetch plutonium to have to go through. It's often weak and only one layer. Yeah, I said that. A password is usually weak obscurity, but think about it, a really good crypto key, 128 bits, is almost by definition obscurity. It's a little compact hunk of obscurity, which you count on. The question is, how do you carry it around with you and use this obscurity to be safe? I think hardware is the only answer to that, by the way. Commitment is a layer. We talked about this before. I used to have attack sensors. I still do it. The stuff Marcus talked about yesterday. Was that yesterday? Yeah, it was. Wow. The stuff he talked about, little alarms, people poking you. And I sort of tried to decide whether the person at the other end was being evil or not. And it was hard. For some things like telnetting in as guest. Well, I mean, that's obviously a good first step to attack a machine. You can go in and look around. There are also other people who would think, I can log in here and run some sample programs from Bell Labs. So maybe they're pure of heart. Can I tell? No. Now, if they try to rlog in as root, I think they've crossed the line, though there are people who said, oh, yeah, I thought it was okay. Anyway, you really want them to break something. And in fact, this is why insurance companies want you to lock your doors. They know the guys can still use a chainsaw to come in. But it shows that someone actually has to commit themselves. It isn't like walking in an unlocked door. And we talked about that. Here is a famous security person doing something, he assures me he doesn't do this anymore, called access hacking, which basically means going where you're not supposed to be. This is Marcus Ranum, by the way. In this particular case, I understand he is in a mail facility up on the third floor. And if you get caught, what do you say? I was looking for the bathroom. They told me to go here, I'm lost, help me out. And he sneaks, and he goes out. And what he has done there has not been forced to commit to something. He doesn't have broken glass on him or anything. There wasn't this layer here for them to determine that he was actually, might have had some evil intent to be there. Now, as far as I know, and I know Marcus pretty well, he wanted to be here, not to steal letters or something. Security, of course, is always a matter of economics. There's how much you're willing to spend to defend something and how much your attacker is willing to spend in terms of time, risk, and money to get it. And you got to balance these and try to make it work. I remember Bob Morris said that there is a surveillance device that costs $100 million that can be frustrated by a $40 item you buy in the hardware store. Now, he never told what the device was or what the item was in the hardware store, though I missed the rest of his talk. I was sitting there trying to think the sort of things and gave him a list of four items at the end of the talk and said, these are the $40 things I think you might do that might frustrate some surveillance. He said, oh, there's one I hadn't seen before. But it's an interesting thing. If you're a little bored sometimes, think about what that surveillance device might be and what you might find in the hardware store. Maybe an ultrasonic bug repeller? I don't know. It's always a matter of economics. The KH-11 spy satellite, the operations manual was sold to the KGB for $3,000. Now, my guess is that we could pass the hat around and get another $3,000 and add it to our libraries. I'd like to see it, and $3,000 is almost what I'd be willing to pay for it. I mean, this was a spy satellite. This was the one with it's the Hubble telescope that points down. Right? It reads licenses and stuff. I would love to have the operations manual. That's cheap. KGB should be selling copies of it. They have lots of good stuff. They published a lot of the stuff they stole from the original bomb-making stuff. And it got out on the net. You can actually find, it appears there's an aluminum sphere inside the plutonium. Anyway, okay, so we'll move along. Oh, there's Tony Sale in Colossus, which was really, according to the Brits anyway, the first stored program computer. Okay, this came out a couple years before the stuff done for the nuclear weapons development. This was built to crack the Tunny code, the German high-level code. And what this really is an investment in more time than the Germans thought was possible. They miscalculated. That when the Enigma cipher was destroyed, was cracked, the Germans actually knew how many different things you'd have to try to break it. They were right. They didn't realize that these guys had come up with the cleverness and time to actually try all those. They had some other cribs and things that helped as well. But one of the keys is your opponent may be willing to actually build a DES cracker. And it's easy to think, no, they'll never do it. But some people do. And I just talked about that. So how are we doing here? Edinburgh Castle. This is intimidating. It's on a rock in Scotland. I mean, it's filled with Scotsmen. Well, it wasn't always. The British had taken it in 1313, and Robert the Bruce wanted to get in, and he talked to a palace guard who used to be in there and would sneak out at night and go down and visit his girlfriend down in town. Turns out that way you could sneak back in with some people. He came in one night. The story goes that the guards were saying, gosh, wouldn't it be funny if someone were sneaking up right now and threw stuff off the edge? Who knows? Anyway, they came in, killed the guards, and opened the door. Insider knowledge is very important, and the convenience of being able to visit your girlfriend is bad in this case. It also fell to a siege, and Bonnie Prince Charlie was unable to break in at one point. So you don't go through security, you go around it. Here's Berwick Castle. You can see this has a failure mode here. There's not much left to it. Edward I, Hammerer of the Scots. Now, there's a hacker name. This is, you know, before. I think some historically related people ought to go back and do some of this stuff. Hammerer of the Scots led the English, and they went up, and the people in the castle, well, they basically said, we fart in your general direction. And they were ready for a long siege. The Scots in the castle jeered the English, so the English went to the nearby town, dragged the people out, and slaughtered them. And the people in the castle said, okay, come on in. That's social engineering. This, of course, is the Alamo. The deal with the Alamo failure mode was that there are 189 defenders and 3,000 Mexicans attacking it. Now, they actually did quite a job. There were actually defenders who snuck in during the siege. If it were my siege, they wouldn't have snuck in. The two-week siege and periodic bombardment, there were 2,000 attackers, stormed it. And a good defense magnifies the cost of a successful attack. 189 people keeping 2,000 at bay, that's pretty good odds. I mean, it's not so good for the 200 people, but it helps get the job done, and it made a rollicking good story. Apparently, the 16 women and children who were inside were spared. So that was a genteeler time, I suppose. Castle failure mode. So how do we do this? Castles failed by sieges, by overwhelming force, back doors. This goes way back. You know, wells, that sort of thing. You sneak in there. And of course, insiders are the major way. All you have to do is get a letter inside and promise one of those poor guards enough money and they'll get in. Most of the bad attacks are insiders, and that's been true all along. There's also arms races. The internet security has an arms race, and I've been watching it now since, I guess, about 1987. You know, we know, well, someday they're going to find this, and it's going to be bad. And then they found it. You know, oh, here's something else they haven't found. Well, we'll try it. I was visiting Andrew Gross down in San Diego about 4 years ago, and he said, you know, I found a stack smashing attack in RStatD. I said, I hadn't heard of that one. I said, I don't think anyone's heard of it. I suggested, put in a detector for it and just leave it on a machine and let me know when it's found in the wild. And about 18 months later, I got email from him. It was found in the wild. What the hell is he talking about? Of course, oh yeah. So there are these recognized vulnerabilities, and we are all watching this. I think the bad guys are ahead myself, because I mean, our code is mostly crap, and it's hard to get it right. And well, anyway, there are antibiotics arms races. First antibiotics came out around 1940, 39, penicillin, and it worked for many years. And we came up with the cephalosporins. And our most recent one, and of course, the bacteria learned this, and we'll go a little bit, believe it or not, in what? Oh, I turned blue. Yep. Boy, this thing is so gone, I can tell you. I'm going to management and just say, you know, it's time. I wonder, can I get a 3-pound which actually has a CD player in it? Do they make that now? No. Darn. I really like the CD player because you can bring a Britannica with you or the GPS. Well, anyway. So there's been this going along, and vancomycin has been so good and it has beat so many bacteria that the drug companies stopped producing new antibiotics around 1980 or so. Oh, we got vancomycin. We're way ahead of the germs. Well, they're starting to show up vancomycin-resistant stuff. Turns out the farmers are feeding this to the cows in low doses, which is exactly the way to teach the bacteria how to resist it. So we've been relying on these single defenses and going through layers, and the bacteria are sort of getting closer and closer, and it's not clear what's going on. We're starting to do this with antiviral agents now. We actually have a couple that fight some types of viral infections, and we're starting to see these arms races there, too. Bacteria change their own genome. I'm going to skip a lot of this biological stuff because it's the end of the day. Chemotherapy is another one. You attack cancer with some potent chemicals, and you kill almost all the cells, but some of them learn the trick and survive. This is the whole idea behind evolution. And you get into this arms race, and maybe the way to do it is to provide multiple chemicals at once so that there's no way it can resist all of them. It turns out, interestingly enough, that there is a pump in the cell that pumps out evil drugs. And both bacteria and cancer cells in our own body have the same chemical pump, plus or minus a little bit, that do the same thing. It's interesting. It's conserved over all of that. So for most of the rest of this talk, I thought I'd look a little more into life, because it's been dealing with a security business now for about 4.2 billion years. And we're just little beginners in this. It's murderous out there. So I'll go through this. Life already has nanotechnology. Proteins are nanotech. They're slippery, sticky, charged, shaped. They flex and fold. You've got leucine zippers and zinc fingers, and they have all sorts of different shapes and little motors that move along and spin and do all sorts of stuff like that. They've got it all. It's all powered by ATP, which pound for pound has as much energy as TNT. But you don't blow up, it just sort of use it. It's a great battery. I look forward to a computer chip that runs on ATP, because if you could put it in the bloodstream, then maybe you wouldn't need a battery for pacemakers and stuff. Assembled with instructions from the nucleus, which of course has the firmware. Levers, wedges, linear rotary motors, I said that. There are debugging tools. We're getting really good at knocking these things out. Well, we take a mouse and we turn this gene off and see if it grows up. So the mouse is a print statement, right? and you can even have it, when you express this gene, add this little extra bit which makes it fluoresce. So when it starts making the protein, you can shine ultraviolet light on it and say, oh, that's where it's making it. So they have these wonderful sorts of print statements that are going in and debugging tools that really let them zoom in on this sort of stuff. And of course, gene sequencing is really something. The software is in the nucleus. There are three of my personal nuclei. Stained with red food coloring. The biological software is a RISC instructions. They're very simple, but there's a complex interpreter. Boy, I'll say. There's a passive software library in the nucleus, which has these machines running up and down it, turning it on, folding it, unfolding it, and basically deciding what gets executed. It is parallel execution, by the way. There is self-modifying code, and it's an important feature, not a bug. There are disassembly projects going on. I get Nature and Science, and these are magazines for those who aren't science people. And every few weeks we have, here is an analysis of the firmware for a new bacterium or a worm or something like that. And even if you don't understand the biochemistry behind it, they have it chunked up. This is the stuff that repairs and fixes DNA. That sounds good. This stuff probably gets rid of poisons. Oh, that's cool. You know, this goes and scavenges important stuff we need. This does energy and, you know, builds cell walls. These are mysterious ones we don't understand, but they probably make it more infectious. It's very cool to look through this because we're starting to look at the firmware. When you look at the firmware, you can actually figure out how they work and maybe do great stuff with them. And of course, they're working on human beings. Here's one. There's one virus, one of the first ones sequenced, has seven proteins encoded in genetic code that have room for only three proteins. How did they do this? Well, the genetic code, it comes in triplets. That's sort of their word size. If you shift the word one or two, you get a completely different code, and you can read it in the other direction. So can you imagine writing an assembly language routine that you execute for a while, and then shift the instructions right three bits and keep executing, and figure out how to do this all? I mean, this is really tight code. very cool stuff. You can patch DNA. There are things like retroviruses, HIV is an example, that will actually put stuff in there, and that's a valuable tool. I mean, that's how you get stuff to execute. Larry Wall, we need a good Perl interpreter patcher for this. Someday it'll be possible to sequence a human being very quickly. The Human Genome Project is moving along, and it'll be done in a year or 2 years or sometime pretty soon, and it will have cost $5 billion. I predict in 30 or 50 years, you'll come home from the hospital with your baby, if we still give birth in hospitals or wherever, and you'll have a CD, which will have your genome, and, you know, for an extra $1,000, the latest analysis of what's going on there. And of course, even if you're worried about clones and stuff, all of us could use a little editing. You know? For example, I seem to be susceptible to these benign things called lipomas. You know, they little lumps that grow in your body. They're not cancerous or anything like that. There's good evidence that lipomas are correlated with something on chromosome 12. And my bet is that there is one stupid base that's wrong. And if we could just flip that one, the lipomas would go away. There are also people who live a lot longer than the rest of us. You know, I want to know what the firmware is. Let's do some point edits. No master race here. Let's just fix some problems. There are lots of things susceptible to breast cancer. All of this stuff, a lot of these are point mutations, single errors. And we ought to be able to get our firmware and edit that. Now, there are hugely scary side effects. this is not a panacea, but it's going to come. We might as well take the good with the bad. Designer genes. For example, recent research showed that if you build a 24th chromosome, there are 23 pairs in the human body, if you build a 24th one and stick all the necessary firmware around it, it will replicate. The cells, oh yeah, here's another one, okay, it'll replicate. Interesting. By the way, chimps have one more or less than we do, which means a chromosome pair, which means that about 5 million years ago, we had the same number. There must have been someone who started with a different number. That's sort of weird. I'm not sure. Microsoft trademark could go in the chromosome. And you know, with some error correction and stuff, truly it would be Microsoft. You could even pay a monthly subscription to a drug that activates it. Yes, as long as you keep taking this drug, your Microsoft chromosome, this is scary stuff. I'm not actually suggesting that Microsoft would do something like that, but you get the idea. We don't know the name. How about a site license? Sell some firmware to the Chinese that makes them not lactose intolerant anymore. That's an idea. So software is under attack all the time. Our DNA is just hugely under attack. The best numbers I've heard is that each cell gets 10,000 mutations a day. Now, that sounds like a lot. Now, remember, there are 3 billion base pairs, and most of that appears to be junk DNA, junk being the scientific word for we don't know what the hell it does. And it may or may not have some structural use. It may just be junk. About half of the 10,000 happens because we're made of water, and the water tends to make these problems. But you also get it from radiation and carcinogens and free radicals from metabolism. I mean, this oxygen stuff is hugely poisonous. It's the second most electronegative element in the universe. It will rip stuff apart. It is just nasty stuff. It was the first big pollutant in the atmosphere. It is just awful. And when your body slowly breaks this down, it leaves little pieces of reactive oxygen around that plays havoc with all of us right now, ruining proteins and messing up our genome. Fortunately, there are a huge barrage of little nanomachines that run along and say, oh, acetylated guanine, this is wrong, get rid of it, fix it. Oh, geez, the whole thing's cut. Let's just glue it back together and make sure it's okay. These little kludges actually probably extend our lives from 7 years to 70, something like that. And you can go look at the urine of people and find all the broken parts, the junkyard. You find the acetylated guanine. And you can actually get some idea of how much assault the body's under. I predict that someday soon, the urinalysis that you go to for the doctor will be a lot more than the half dozen things they check for now. And it's important stuff. But there's a whole bunch of stuff going on there, coming out, that has a huge diagnostic value that we're not using yet. And if the cell wants to divide, there's even a nanomachine system that says, can't divide yet, software is a mess. Clean up this mess before I let you split. And in fact, one of the things that cancer seems to do is mess that up. I'd say, go ahead, it's all right, stop fussing. And so you get bad replication, and that's bad. What it normally does, it has this checkpoint stuff. It looks through and says, gosh, this is a real mess. I think I'd better die. And it neatly buds itself off into little packages, and the cell becomes raw material for the rest of the body, and other cells come along and scavenge it up and recycle it. So it's okay to throw away code if it seems bad. There are about 50 trillion cells in the body. The repair efficiency is really good. And there are some genes that seem to be very good at it. By the way, the antioxidants like vitamin C, folic acid, vitamin E seem to be really good at fighting those antioxidants, those free radicals. Virus, of course, actually modifies the cell. And this is just like they do in computers, right? Same stuff. And in fact, my dad, I was on CNN back in 1989, my first real public appearance, talking about computer viruses. Boy, they were so easy back then. And my dad said, you know, you call these things viruses, but are they really the same? Well, they're not biological, but the way they work is exactly the same, as you all know. And they are clearly one of the major causes of cancer, because they like to go in and mess up the cell regulation stuff. I mean, human papillomavirus that gives you warts. Its big deal is to make things keep growing when they shouldn't be. And that's just the way cancers begin. They can be useful. You know, it's a great way to insert new code. This is Larry Wall's tool when he's going to do this. And of course, if you have already are under attack, maybe you use some exponential attack against it. That's scary, stupid stuff. I talked about apoptosis. That's programmed cell death. This is the moral equivalent of a computer saying, I'm under attack, I better shut myself down. Now, of course, when you have 50 trillion cells, it's okay to destroy a few. If your web page, web server is only one, then this is just a denial of service attack. But it's an interesting idea. Telomeres, oh yes, we're coming along here. This won't be too much longer. These are chromosomes. And these little dots at the end, they sort of look like worm eyes, are telomeres. They are the aglets. Or they're little bits of repeating information at the end of the strand of DNA that keep it from unraveling. And every time the DNA splits, the telomeres get a little shorter. Can you say TTL field? Because when you run out of telomeres, the cell either stops splitting forever, or it keeps going and it all unravels and dies because it becomes a huge mess. And the telomeres are clearly the body's way of controlling exponential growth, which is an important thing. The Morris worm, when it came out, spread too quickly. It was pretty clear it was intended to just quietly go into the universe and sneak around. And what it really did was had a bug in it, and it went exponential very quickly, and it was clear the author didn't intend that. The problem is it's really hard to keep exponential growth in control, and that's what telomeres are for. It's called the Hayflick limit. They learned back in the 60s that if you take some cells and just let them divide, they'll only divide 50 or 60 times, and then they'll look sort of old and shoddy, as eyes start to get. And it turns out there must be a clock that remembers, and it's the telomeres. And you can go back there, and there's something called telomerase, which puts it back and makes the cell young again. Doesn't that sound like a great idea? Wouldn't you like to have some of that? Maybe. But of course, the exponential growth it's trying to stop is cancer. And one of the first things most cancer cells have is telomerase turned on. They want the cells to be cancer, immortal cancer cells, keep growing. And one of the most intriguing ways of treating cancer may be to suppress the telomerase. So the cancer cells die of old age. They just blow their 50 divisions and that's it. It's found in a lot of them. Very interesting. The sheep Dolly, when it was, it was grown up, it had used up some of its TTL, and they went and took some of that and made a new sheep out of it. And the question was, this was a couple of years ago, did that sheep start with a short TTL field? And it turns out the answer is yes. The offspring are getting older sooner. And they've done this with mice as well. You can just say, no telomerase. And they go for about five generations, and then they just can't grow anymore because their aglets, their telomeres get too short. This, by the way, was a similar problem that was on the internet very early days. So having that TTL field, if you didn't have that, then the packets would keep going forever. Morris worm, Telescript, that's a whole area there. They said, we'll send little programs around. And since the programs might replicate, well, we'll give them teleclicks, which is a time to live field. And so the thing would go out. You get into this whole problem that, okay, I want to send you a program, I want to send you mail. And I send this little program which goes over and executes and delivers you the mail and gives me something coming back. Well, obviously, if this little program can go around, you think virus. I'm a bad guy, I'll just spread these things around and they'll just clog up the whole system. And they said, no, we'll put in teleclicks. You only have so much gas in each program. That's the teleclicks. So you send it out, and well, now supposing the mail arrives, but there aren't enough teleclicks to deliver it. Well, it stops executing, it disappears. How would you like to be on the user helpline when the call comes in? My mail has disappeared. I don't know why it didn't arrive. Well, you don't have enough teleclicks. Well, do you want my credit card number? What do you do with the teleclicks? So they said, oh, okay, well, we'll have an extra tank, a reserve tank. You get this many, and the program will have this little interrupt routine when you get down to certain enough, so that if it makes it, but it doesn't run, but it runs out of teleclicks, it'll have enough in reserve to send itself back and report that it ran out of teleclicks. So now you're the user agent. Oh, yes, it didn't get delivered. You didn't have enough teleclicks in here. Well, give me more, damn it. This whole thing gets very hard, and I always get worried when people talk about sending programs around, because this problem is inherently difficult. Biological systems have a hard time with it, and so do we. A few other things about it. The biosystem uses crypto. There are secret keys. There are things called HLA antigens, which are initialized when you're born, actually conceived. And this is a sequence of stuff on the cells that say, I am me. And these cells go around tasting, and if you don't have the right key, they launch an attack. This is how organs get rejected. There are public keys, which prevent interspecies breeding. You know, all the males are this, all the females are this. If you don't have the right one at the cellular level, don't fit in, the union doesn't work, or is non-functional. There are hash functions. When viruses get into your cell, they take over the protein system. They start making their own proteins. The cell has a system that gets rid of proteins, chops it up into 8 or 9 bit hunks, and puts it on the surface of the cell. This is my garbage. The body has sort of a list of acceptable garbage. Yep, that's good. When the virus comes along, it has this new different protein. Chop, 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 goes out to the surface. Uh-oh, you're wrong, that cell dies. Okay, that's a hash function. And in fact, the most successful viruses have some way to interfere with that hash function. Evolution and software bloat. Yeah, I talked about that, scrub your DNA. I mean, DNA, our DNA contains hunks that viruses inserted a long time ago. It'd be fun to clean some of that out. But there's a question about whether that enhances evolution, and maybe that'd be a bad guy. Bad guys share their tricks, happens at conferences like this and magazines like this. Up here, bacteria trade their plasmids. Hey, I'm still alive. You want some of my DNA? Yeah, sure. This worked for me. You know, I had a bad case of penicillin. Try this. They even do it through different species. They trade this stuff. Pretty amazing. So can we draw some deeper lessons from the biosphere? I mean, we're just beginners on this. Exponential growth is hard to control, period. If you have some great new idea that has replicating programs going out into some space, someplace, you're going to have to face this, and my bet is you're not going to succeed. Defense in depth is good, we knew that. Apoptosis, maybe there's a lesson there. I don't know, this is a bit of a stretch, but it's interesting to look at this stuff and find that it's all sort of the same. There's no such thing as perfect security. Some of us will die from bacteria and other things, and that's okay because the rest of us survive. That's all right with the life system in general. Abscam proved that, we knew that, as Bob Morris said, we knew that a congressman could be bought, we just didn't know that I could afford one. The human immune system isn't perfect, but it's good enough, and that's always something we're going for. I mean, there's no such thing as perfect security. Frequent password changes. Yeah, password changes in malaria. I can go into that. Monocultures are dangerous. You don't plant Kansas with one strain of wheat, because when the wrong thing comes along, it will wipe out the whole state. Now, that, of course, suggests, well, is Windows 98 one strain of wheat in our fields of the internet? And the answer is yes, and that is dangerous. Now, the moral of the story might be that you should all go home and write your own operating system. But I don't think that's going to happen for most places. We did at our place, and as a result, we're pretty resistant to a lot of the attacks that go on out there. But this is an interesting problem. The world is getting QWERTYized in our operating systems, just as we have a crappy keyboard because the wrong one won back in 1889. We're now stuck with that, and we are setting standards for the future. And whatever standards we pick, we may end up with monocultures that'll be easier to hit. And we're getting new monocultures, too. The Java executable is a monoculture. the operating system, you know, one particular popular Red Hat Linux is a monoculture for that. It all happens here. Transitive closure attack, I attack A and then go to B. That happens in nature all the time. It turns out the model for flu, where does flu come from? The new strains? Well, the ducks seem to fly around with it. They land with the pigs in southeast China, where ducks and pigs live together on the farm. The pigs catch it from the ducks. It mutates, changes, and eventually the pigs give it to the farmers, and that's where we get the next Asian flu. And that is one of the reasons that we get so many flus from influenza from that part of the world. And does this sound like a fairly common attack? There are other ways, but it's frequently what happens. H5N1 was the scary new flu that popped up about a year or two ago in Hong Kong. Looked like it was a real killer. That's going to hit us. Talked about that. Yeah. Other pending targets. I think that about does it for me. This has been fun. I actually looked around the hotel looking for more security stuff, but you know, a little bubble in the ceiling with a camera isn't very impressive. I guess the best part is those carts they reel around that have money and the little light saying, I am here. So you can keep an eye on it. They're not going to run away with that. So anyway, that's basically my talk, and thank you very much.